are convincing. The evidences of success are abundant. Experienced advocates are available. And the measure of success, our success, will be driven by our planning and by our commitment. Thank you.
Thank you. Commander Coleman, on behalf of the committee, we'd like to thank you with quite a report. I'm sure there's lots of things in there that we could do. And I ask you if you're welcome to sit up here with us if you have your time and listen to the rest of the forum.
I'd like to stay for a while, but I'm going to try to break a little bit early. I have to go way back downstate. Into the teeth of the storm.
You're talking to the person that has to do the same thing. Thank you.
Thank you for your invitation.
Before I go any further, let me recognize up here. We have first of all, the committee has set this up, and I'd like them to be recognized as Bill Orwell, who just stepped out for a moment. Pete Sutton is right at the end there. And Rick Weidman is back there that brings me up the notes. Dead main. Up here, I like to you recognize the young lady at the end. There is Betty DeMarco, relations to me. She's the state chairman for the Ladies Auxiliary of the Veterans of Foreign Wars, legislative chairman. Next to her is Bob Becker. He's a senior vice commander in chief, I think they call him, in the Marine Corps League. And next to him is Gary Flattery, who is the NCOs.
Non-commissioned officers.
Next to her is Delisa D. James, who's with the Paralyzed Veterans. To my right, we have another president, state president of the Vietnam Veterans of America, John Roden. And at this time, I'm going to ask, if possible, try to keep me within 10 minutes. Otherwise, we may have a problem today. I love to hear all these fully, but we do have it written here, and I'm sure, I guarantee you that this committee will read every one of those and go over it page by page. So I'm going to ask, try to keep you within 10 minutes, and we'll get this thing moving along. Next, we're going to have Ms. Dottie O'Donnell, Executive Director of Saratoga Rural Preservation Company.
Thank you, Honorable Tochi, Ralph DeMarco, President, and committee members, veterans, and ladies and gentlemen. I am not going to read testimony because it'll be repetitive of the very clearly defined statistics that you heard from Mr. Behan and Mr. Coleman. Rather, I'd like to tell you about what we do and the plight of not-for-profits in the country today. The not-for-profits, mine included, rely heavily on my ability to secure funding. And that also relies on the census reports. The census that was taken for 1990, I had a shelter then. Now I have a supportive living environment. They report that there was one homeless person living in Saratoga County, even though they interviewed all of my homeless veterans that year. That means that when I respond and write for funding through governmental agencies and I say, we have one veteran, one homeless, in Saratoga County, they say I don't need the funding. However, I have a transitional facility in Ballston Spa, New York. It's a 10-bedroom. Veterans are screened very rigorously to find out where they are in their programs, where they are in their lives. Are they committed to their own well-being? Are they committed to being stabilized and productive members of the community? They are not, they are encouraged to stay for a year with us. It has been my experience that 28-day programs, 3-month programs, do not change the behavior that that is built up in a lifetime. The recidivism rate at our facility is extremely low, where alcoholism and substance abuse is the successful recovery is extremely low. We don't find that. As long as we can get our people to follow programs and behave and be trained and educated, and we do an awful lot of group therapy, in-house programs, and these two gentlemen, for instance, are living there currently. We also have a permanent housing project for homeless veterans and their families 16 miles away from Boston Spa. It's affordable housing in a community that is fashionable, Saratoga, wealthy, where rents are out of sight. You cannot afford the rents in Saratoga. We also run a Section 8 rental assistance program, so I can attest to that. PTSD, Mr. Coleman said it very nicely. Homelessness can create chronic mental illness. Post-traumatic stress disorder is chronic mental illness. Anyone in the clinical field will tell you that if you are depressed, when they're working with people who are highly depressed because of extreme stressors, typically they self-medicate. It doesn't matter if you're a veteran, it doesn't matter who you are. Self-medication is a very prevalent practice. Post-traumatic stress disorder with a combat, the theater vet, especially with the wars that have been publicized and viewed for the first time, beginning with Vietnam, where I had three brothers serve. The economy wasn't to be. People came home from those wars. There wasn't an economy. There wasn't a job. There wasn't housing. Did they self-medicate? Yes. Did they stay married? No. Were they young people, men and women? Some 17 who went over to serve our country. Had they identified their own sexuality yet? Absolutely not. I'm here to tell you that if you give people a chance and you assist in training new behaviors, they can be productive, stable members of your community. They can be voting members of a community. They can work in your businesses. With that, I will turn that over to Kevin O'Connell. We haven't taught him structure yet.
My name is Kevin O'Connell. Basically, I just wanted to, what was alluded to earlier, my own idea on what homelessness is about. It's more of a function of larger societal ills, like economic mismanagement and greed. Getting off of that and getting to my own case, I'm a U.S. Navy submarine service veteran, 9 years. And I've worked all my life, basically. Why I became homeless, I would say, is, changing jobs because of reduction in workforces, softening economic markets, changing areas. In my own case, I'm an alcoholic. I also suffer from clinical depression, but I managed to stay functional because I built up a support network. But when you have to move to change jobs because of the economic stressors, you lose that because you have to change areas and start all over. And in my case, I wound up moving to Boston from a rural area to a large city, and I had a lot of difficulties with that. And that's basically what happened. I did have my own home. I lost that. I lost my job. And basically became homeless, going to shelters, to hospitals, to detoxes, staying with friends, staying with other people, you know, staying in places where no one else is staying. And that's just the way it is. There is people out there in our organizations and agencies which do provide assistance and do help somewhat. In my own case, you know, some of the problems that I found is with the shelters, there's overcrowded conditions because there just isn't enough room. I don't believe that many people realize just how many people are out there. And of course, that leads to, if you're already depressed, coming out of a detox or coming out of a treatment facility, shelters is the place to go because it's cheap. But is that the best interest of someone who's already depressed to go to a more depressing environment? And that's basically what happens, and that's one of the reasons I feel that the recidivism rate is so high with that, is that hopelessness. It's that simple. Staffing, many times in my own experiences, or clients or former clients that are given employment opportunities there, and they're not really trained or skilled in how to deal with many problems that homelessness has. It's like homelessness is multifaceted. It's economic, it affects you emotionally. We're talking about mental illnesses, financially, and even your self-esteem, your dignity, you know, all that tends to get stripped away, and it's a process of trying to get that back. And that's where the assistance is really needed. Halfway houses, again, availability, and in most cases, because of the substance abuse issues, many specialize. They're looking for alcoholics that don't have other substance abuse problems, or alcoholics or substance abusers that don't have mental issues. In other words, because of the medication issue, has they don't want it around. If you're taking some kind of psych med or mood elevator, or mood altering, you know, substance because of another illness. Locations of a lot of halfway houses are in drug infested areas because, of course, that's the only place where there's a low resistance to putting a facility like that in that area. No one complains. In a lot of cases, it's an improvement in the area. And that's kind of sad because, again, putting someone who's trying to get well into the area that they're trying to get away from, you know, again, recidivism, you have a problem with, or I have a problem with, I should say, this is me. Outpatient treatment programs. I was, by trade and profession, I was a computer systems analyst for a federal agency, my last employment. So it's not a matter that I'm under-trained or under-educated. But it seems like with the new managed care philosophies that let's try what costs less first and see how that works. And in my own case, I went the whole gamut right down to where I didn't have to worry about managed care because I didn't have any more health insurance once I lost my job. So. And that's basically where that seems to go. Let's try a little of this. Let's go to a substance abuse counselor rather than a psychiatrist or whatever. Whatever's cheaper, whatever will keep the profit margin where it should be. My opinion, again. And again, that's also to keep you in the workforce, which is, in some cases, a good idea, but in other cases, the continued stressors, the anxiety, wondering how other people perceive you, especially with a drug problem, it's difficult. And a lot of it's self-induced and some of it is real, you know, real prejudices and real problems with that. financial problems, you know, of course, losing your job, you know, you don't have any money. But then when you're trying to get better, public assistance programs, as already stated, you know, like there's cutbacks and everything. And, you know, I guess there's not money available for anything. Saying or trying to explain to people that you're disabled for whatever reason, especially in my case where physically I'm fine. I don't have any physical problems at all. But with depression, I don't know how to explain it, except that, you know, I get to the point sometimes where I couldn't call into work. And it's not because I was drunk or under the influence of drugs. It's because I just couldn't call. And I don't know if anyone here knows anyone that suffered from depression, but that's what it does to you. You just can't do things that normal people do, untreated. Social Security system, what I indicated there with my experience is you have to live long enough to get any help. I mean, you apply, and I applied in August of 1994, and it's still in the process. Medicaid, when I came out of the last treatment facility, the VA hospital here in Albany, they indicated that I should go to an intensive treatment program. And for that kind of, I had to go to Medicaid to see about that. But I do have some resources and some income. But the one thing they don't count is I also have three children, but child support isn't a deductible expense when figuring whether you're eligible for Medicaid. So you can get Medicaid, but your children lose out, and you're a deadbeat dad. So figure that one out, folks. The other thing really is vocational rehabilitation. The VA does have a good program going as far as the veterans industries. I think they're getting better with it, but it's to be able to reintroduce oneself into the workforce and do something that you feel good about and that you can earn a decent wage where you can afford to support your family and be a productive veteran to the society, and also to, you know, contribute to the tax base of whatever community you're in. And it just makes sense. And it is cost effective because the way the programs run, I guess they do a lot, you know, with the hospitals, which reduce the cost of the government in general. That's about all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. O'Connell. Would you please keep it a little brief, please?
Yes,
otherwise, we may run into problems. We have quite a list of.
Yes, sir. Yeah, my name is Mike Supernot. I'm an era vet. I didn't see any battle or anything. I'm an Air Force. I did aircraft upholstery, survival equipment. I've been an auto upholsterer for 20 years. That's a real specialty. I just wanted to come here. I wanted to apologize. I submitted a statement, and it was kind of lengthy, and I didn't get to really edit it or anything, and it's a little bit far-fetched, but I just wanted to get the opportunity to come up here and give my little piece what it's like to be homeless and what it's like to get there. And and admittedly, I'm also an addict. I'm an addict. I'm in a full-time recovery program. This is my second time. I've been in sobriety for 5 months now. Was also recently diagnosed with bipolar disorder. I'm on medication, deep depression. I didn't realize it. I've probably had it for many years. And I could talk about a lot of stuff. I just want to try to illustrate what it's like. I am from Saratoga Springs, and I got to the point where, after trying to be on my own, I have a family, I have three children, I'm divorced. My ex-wife has multiple sclerosis. I took care of her for many years, and eventually I got involved with heavier drugs. I began in criminal activity, and nothing real serious, but bad enough. I've been to jail. After going to jail, that's when I lost my family. I got a good start when I came out, and worked hard while in doing time in a county jail. I restarted my job trade in the Capital District, and after about 8 months, had been re-involved with drugs and relapsed. And that was a period of abstinence. I wasn't in a formal recovery at the time. But basically, after staying with parents for a short time and eventually got to the point where they could not tolerate or could not afford to have me stay there either. And just gets to the point where I basically had to go to public assistance, and ultimately I could not get a room per se. I ended up in the shelter of Saratoga, which is a small shelter, and they referred me to RPC, and that was the first time I stayed there. I stayed there for 3 months. I'll try to wrap this up. And basically, after getting into a recovery program, my first attempt, I took my will back and went out of state and went to Florida to try to start my life over. And that's, for my trade, that was the place to go. And it didn't work out. I went back too soon, and I shouldn't have done that. Ultimately, I ended up coming back to New York State after 14 months. I lost my job in 10 months. Which was really good for me, but it was nevertheless, I lost it and had to come back, and found myself staying at relatives' house and bounced from one house to another until I had played out my my stay. And it got to the point where I totally shut down. I literally just could not even utter to speak to anybody. That's how bad I was. And it didn't take a lot of drug use to do that, but I ended up in the VA hospital, and thankfully, Dottie O'Donnell and the RPC allowed me to get back into the home, and you know, as long as I was clean and trying to do the right thing, and I'm trying to do that now, and things have really been going well. It's very hard to do. It's hard to change the way you live. Hoping to just be successful. I'm looking forward to getting ahead. I can't go to work right now. You know, I that's not the right thing to do. A lot of us who are, it's not a wise thing to go back out into you know, society. In the first year, it's recommended in recovery. Many different schools of thought kind of think that. I think that proved true for me. And anyway. It's been really, really helpful for me. I don't know where else I would have gone. And Dottie herself, with her own resources, really goes way out of her way to try to help a lot of us out. And, you know, I hope to get back out there quickly. I'm also, you know, I'm a professional musician. I play drums. I do a lot of things, you know. But when you're out there, you know, it's... Doesn't matter what you are. I just wanted to say that. I really don't have a lot else.
Thank you. I want to introduce you to Carl Pink, who is the new staff person, who is a veterans advocate. But more importantly, Michael Beyond and Kevin Beyond having their own skills. We now know that they're also skilled in public speaking, but I think that this gives us, these two gentlemen, an opportunity also to increase self-esteem. So I have to thank you for that.
Chairman, go ahead. Do you want to make a remark?
You were first.
We have a question. Gary has a question.
Please go ahead.
Yeah, I would like to ask the two gentlemen, what do you think would be the most important thing that we can do as a council overall to improve the lot of the homeless vet?
Yes.
Development of a multifaceted approach, because it's a multifaceted issue. And it's not one particular thing to attack. And, different individuals have different problems, and to look at the different variables that are part of the overall homeless problem, because it's going to be different case to case, just as people are different.
But there has to be some priorities.
Well, I think the biggest ones are really vocational rehabilitation, and, something, and that's something to look at as far as what's available, and, to give someone some hope, really hope and dignity. Those are the big ones.
I just, the only thing I'd say is a little far out, because I don't have a real direct answer, because when I think about that, I think about, for veterans, that's very important to me and to all of us here in this room, that's what we're here for. And the truth is that we cannot forget, and I try to limit that, the fact that there's a lot of us homeless, regardless if you're a veteran, a citizen, whoever you are. And, perhaps that's a consideration that they need to keep that in mind when I don't know how else to say it. There's so much about it, because on the other hand, some of us recover and we go back out there, and then here you have this whole structure of support and all this other stuff. I don't know. It's very complicated to me.
Mr. Effie, am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Supernaut.
I'm sorry, Mr. Supernaut. I want to talk to you just a moment about your experience in the court, in the jail. Would I be correct in assuming that you were charged with misdemeanor crimes?
No.
Okay.
No.
At the time...
Initially, yeah. I have one.
All right. Let me deal then with the time that you spent either in a town court or a city court. Did anyone talk to you at that point or attempt to identify whether or not you were a veteran? It's just a yes or a no.
I don't think so.
When you were imprisoned, did you receive any services as an incarcerated veteran?
I just can't remember that, if there was really anything in particular. No. No.
Okay. Donnie, are you aware of any of the programs?
I work within two incarcerated facilities, Mount McGregor Corrections and Great Meadows. And they do have a quad that is a veteran quad, and we do some PTSD groups, and they do a lot of ASAT and DSAT programs at those two facilities. We serve, RPC serves many times as alternatives to incarceration also. However, I do want to let you know that alternatives to incarceration could be a very cost-saving value to the state of New York in many ways, dependent upon the crime and the person. Because if you have a misdemeanor or a felony conviction and it's based on abuse, substance abuse, you are not going to get any kind of treatment within the facility, the local jail.
John Roden.
First of all, I'd like to thank the
participants, particularly the two gentlemen, for coming forward, because I think it helps dispel the myth that somehow that homeless veterans or homeless in general are only found in New York City, on the streets of New York City, and that upstate New York has got a significant problem as well. And I also think, given the backgrounds of these gentlemen, that also dispels some of the rumors that the only people who end up on the street are those who have been derelicts from the day they were born, practically, or if you listen to some people. And also, to some extent, they're also not black, I think is a key issue, too, because too often this issue just gets shunted aside because it's a minority problem. It's not our problem. Well, it's everybody's problem. And so I'm glad that you were able to participate today. And I guess my question is, as a provider of services in a rural area or a rural setting, do you see yourself much different from your urban counterparts in any way? Is there anything in particular that would be handled differently than we might do in an urban setting?
I've visited many of the facilities locally to learn how to better be an administrator of my own. And I visited a lot of the shelters, and they have to be commended. Boston and New York, they really do. They're dealing with so many numbers as the compared to the rural areas, honestly, even though we have, you know, our share of target population.